Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Okay, I know finance is complicated and all, but seriously, how do you lose $1.2 billion? Also, those television ads. How come they're always so loud? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 13th of December. Good as always to have you with us. John Corzine, once the CEO of Goldman Sachs, once a senator from New Jersey, once the governor of the Garden State, was in front of another congressional panel today that was inquiring about the most recent entry on his resume, CEO of the failed brokerage firm MF Global. In particular, Corzine's former colleagues in the Senate wanted to know what happened to the money. $1.2 billion in customer accounts, about which Mr. Corzine has said this.
I simply do not know where the money is.
We wondered how that could be, since it's a whole lot of money. So we called the woman whose job it is to find money when it goes missing. Tiffany Couch is a forensic accountant in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Okay, so come on. $1.2 billion? How do you lose that?
You don't.
Okay. Then how did this happen?
I think there is a way to trace the money. Unless the money is withdrawn from a bank account in the form of cash and it walks out the door in somebody's pocket or their briefcase, then there's always a way to trace money.
So let's say Congress comes to you, the agriculture committees in either one of the houses, and says, listen, Ms. Couch, you are a forensic accountant. Help us find this missing $1.2 billion. What are you going to do? How are you going to go about it?
I'm going to ask for those bank statements right away and verify whether or not the money's still sitting there or whether or not it was dispersed electronically. The last thing I'm going to look at are canceled checks, physical documents that would show, you know, how the money was spent.
Is there any doubt in your mind that you would be able to figure it out? I mean, banking is a heavily papered industry.
There's no doubt. Might it be complicated? Sure. But this kind of money is always going to be traceable.
So make a guess for me. Where do you think it went? And while acknowledging you don't know the specifics of the case, what could possibly have happened?
There are so many ways money can be. Might it still be sitting there? Sure. Might have investments been made that were poor and the money was lost that way? That could be one way. Might the money have been transferred over into operating accounts in order to make payroll, pay rent, and the operating expenses of a company? That's a third way.
Is it necessarily malfeasance that this money's not around?
No.
Then the other choice that comes to my mind is stupidity.
Sometimes you have poor accounting practices, and it can just be a huge accounting mess. That is not necessarily a criminal act.
You know, it's funny because early on in this saga, at one point, MF Global said, oh, we found the money. We found part of it. It's at J.P. Morgan Chase. And J.P. Morgan Chase came back and said, oh, no, that's $600 billion? That's ours. How common? Yeah, I know, right? How common is it for this kind of thing to happen in a major financial institution?
I would say it's extremely uncommon. I mean, when our bank statements come to our homes every single month and tells us how much money we have in our bank account, 99% of us rely on that number and know that if we needed to walk into the bank and withdraw that money, it's there. So to have something like this happen has got to be extremely uncommon.
Tiffany Couch, a forensic accountant out of Portland, Oregon. Tiffany, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, Marketplace listeners, time to put your hands together, make some noise if you love loud television ads. Yeah, that's what I thought. You know what? Congress isn't so wild about them either. Last year, it passed something called the Commercial Advertising Loudness Mitigation Act, the COM Act. You get it? It says television commercials can be no louder than the shows they interrupt, or augment, I guess the advertising industry would say. The Federal Communications Commission released the details this morning. Cable companies and network broadcasters have a year to comply, which means what exactly for the advertising industry? Marketplace's Gregory Warner went to find out.
Picture yourself in bed watching television, getting kind of sleepy, then a commercial comes on with a bang. It cleans, it brightens, it eliminates odors. Don't just get it clean, get it OxiClean.
At that moment, inside your brain, the relative loudness of the ad triggers a response that evolved 400 million years ago. It was intended to keep us from being eaten by amphibious predators. It's called fight or flight.
You might have sweaty palms, your heart rate and your respiration has increased. You've got all this excess energy caused by the startle reflex. Of course you're annoyed.
Daniel Levitin studies the cognitive neuroscience of sound at McGill University. He's the author of This Is Your Brain on Music. So why do advertisers feel the need to torture us in this way?
Well, that's an interesting question. Why would advertisers want to scare you? It turns out that it's an attention-getting device.
And not just that. Carl Howe analyzes media for the Yankee Group in Boston. He says an ad that alarms, even an ad that annoys, can be very memorable, very sticky.
The real trouble with loud ads is that it's an ever-escalating war.
Of each ad outshouting the last. The new FCC ruling requires broadcast and cable channels to play TV ads at the same volume as the TV shows. Howe says that could force the loudmouths to turn up the creativity.
If they know they're going to have to compete on the content of their message rather than the volume, they'll work to create a more effective message.
Effective, but not necessarily less annoying.
There are more ways to be obnoxious than just shouting at people, absolutely.
So as calm as we can in Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
All was well on Wall Street today until birthday boy Ben Bernanke ruined it. The Fed chairman is 58 years old today. We'll have the details on interest rates, not the birthday, when we do the numbers. A report out here in California last week shows that less than half the families in this state are middle class anymore. And yes, part of that's bad economy, but the Public Policy Institute of California says it's bigger than just that, that it's part of a 30-year trend. The wine-growing mecca of Napa, California, is trying to change that, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
The road sign welcoming visitors to Napa Valley quotes Robert Louis Stevenson, "The wine is bottled poetry." Locals are happy to elaborate.
There's a little tiny bit of a vanilla character and a little bit of toastiness. We have a depth of fruit, but it's really delivered in a silky package.
Napa Valley is a pastoral playground for the wealthy. Health spas, world-class restaurants, and 400 wineries. But there is another Napa.
Jose, what do your parents do for work?
My mom works at McDonald's and my dad works at a winery.
And what do you want to do when you grow up?
I want to be a winery person like my dad.
Winery jobs draw mostly Hispanic workers. Napa has one of the fastest growing Latino populations in the nation. The valley basically gets two kinds of newcomers, affluent retirees at the top.
And at the bottom, you see people coming here not to retire, but to work in agriculture, construction, hospitality, manufacturing, sort of the central engines of our economy.
Terrence Mulligan is president of the Napa Valley Community Foundation, which funds local programs aimed at bridging the wealth gap.
Our greatest worry about our future in Napa Valley is that we will look like Vail in 20 years because the growth in this community is at the very top and at the very bottom.
He says Hispanic immigrants at the bottom need to move up the economic ladder if there's going to be a middle class here in 20 years. And in order to qualify for professional middle-class careers, Hispanic kids need to start doing better in school.
As an example, last year, out of one particular high school, only 18 kids out of 250 had taken the right classes to even apply to a public university.
Leslie Medine is executive director of a nonprofit called On the Move. She's focused on education as the key to growing a middle class. McPherson Elementary School is almost entirely Latino. A variety of programs have been tailored to help students excel. Starting in fourth grade, leadership academies teach kids about various careers. For parents, there's a family resource center where Pablo Trujillo works.
I'm teaching them how to sustain themselves with their finances, basically help them with budgets.
Most immigrants know very little about our school system. So a program called Parent University teaches them the basics. Hispanic mothers fill a classroom. They've come to learn about a foreign concept, the parent-teacher conference. Fabiola Osorio helps run Parent University. She remembers how hard it was when she moved here from Mexico with her son.
It was frustrating not knowing how to help him with homework, how to communicate with the teacher, and even harder try to understand like the test results. So it was very frustrating for me.
The program is pragmatic, but also symbolic. Again, Leslie Medine.
Even though many of our parents never even graduated high school, the idea that the parents are going to parent university and they're calling it university also helps the kids say, oh, my mom or my dad is going to university.
She hopes the kids on the playground today will be inspired to go to university themselves someday, then come back and serve as role models to show other Hispanic kids that middle-class careers are attainable. That's a long way off, but they're making progress. On recent test scores, McPherson's students, the kids of poor Hispanic immigrants, showed as much academic progress as the rich kids at the best-funded schools. In Napa, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
When I was living in Beijing back in the mid-90s, I'd go out for a long bike ride on a Saturday, and I'd come back hacking and coughing like I was a two-pack-a-day smoker. But bad as the air was back then, it's nothing compared to what's been happening lately. Smog so thick that hundreds of planes were grounded at the Beijing airport last week. So we sent Marketplace's Rob Schmitz up from Shanghai to Beijing a couple of days ago to ask around, see what people are saying. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so what are they telling you out on the streets, man? It must be a mess.
Yeah, I mean, Beijing is sort of infamous for, you know, these sandstorms and bouts of severe pollution. So people here are sort of used to all this, but there seems to be this growing sense of frustration from people who live here. Years ago, I think people were more tolerant of all this pollution because they knew that it was a byproduct of development. Well, now many here in Beijing have made their money. They're getting comfy and the pollution is still here and it impacts your health and the health of your children. So I spoke to a young man named Zhang Yue yesterday. He was outside a pharmacy that was doing very good business, selling air filter face masks. He told me Beijing's air pollution has had a huge impact on how he lives.
Give us the translation. What's he saying?
So you know how in America we choose a house based on the school district or how safe the area is, things like that?
Yeah.
Well, Zhang just bought a new home, and he's telling me the biggest factor behind his purchase was air quality. He says he picked the least polluted part of the city to buy an apartment. So here we have the biggest economic decision of this guy's life being determined by air pollution.
That's crazy. What's the government doing, if anything?
Well, throughout last week, officials insisted on labeling the pollution bad weather. They called it fog. They refused to call it smog.
Nobody really believes that, though, right? I mean, come on.
No. And that's why a lot of people are just angry. They're sick of being lied to like this by a government that's supposed to be taking care of them. People who are really concerned about this are following a Twitter feed from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. The U.S. Embassy here has been monitoring the air from a machine on its roof. It spits out hourly air quality readings and posts them on Twitter. And all last week, the readings were categorized as either very unhealthy or hazardous. On one day last week, the pollution was so bad that it went beyond what the machine could even read. Oh. So, you know, it was pretty clear, you know, don't go outside.
Is there, I mean, are people not going to work? I mean, what's the economic impact?
Last week, a lot of the roads were closed. Folks, I think, had a hard time getting stuff to marketing and going to work. But I think what's more important here is that there's been a 60% increase in lung cancer in the past decade. So that's going to have a tremendous toll on China's healthcare system. You know, the World Bank figures China loses $100 billion a year from pollution. That's 6% of China's GDP. Excuse me, I'm actually coughing right now.
Nice.
I just got here yesterday. Sorry about that. Just last week, hundreds of flights were canceled in and out of Beijing because the pilots couldn't see through all this smog. China's economy is definitely taking a hit because of this.
Let's pick up on that coughing spell you just had. What's it doing to you? I mean, you don't like go outside and run, do you?
Well, you know, I do. I like to run, and I've got asthma, and so I'm pretty sensitive about how bad the air is, especially after a run. I've got a 3-year-old son, and you know, he's also showing early signs of asthma. So earlier this year, my wife and I spent $6,000 on the best air filters that we could find here, and you know, that was a big investment for us. I mean, that's more than I spent on my last car back in the States. You know, I've got another son on the way, so I thought that this was really important, you know, but I'm lucky. Most Chinese people can't afford air filters like that.
Rob Schmitz, usually in Shanghai, today in Beijing, giving us our weather forecast. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Coming up,
when it comes to the food scene, very often in America, the child is in charge, and that means soft and sweet and gooey.
Soft and sweet and gooey, just like Freakonomics, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. So the Fed stayed the course, and that snuffed out the rally. The Dow Industrials gave back 66 points today, about a 0.5%, close at 11,954. The NASDAQ shed 32 points, 1.25%, 2579 at the bell. The S&P 500 down 10 points, 0.8%. Ended things at 1,225. Stocks had climbed until the Fed meeting adjourned. Its announcement had some good news, some cautions, but no new action to bolster the economy. So more than half the blue chips ended in the red, led by Alcoa's decline of 3.33% today. Retail figures today showed that electronic shoppers are demanding discounts. That took a toll on Best Buy. Shares of the big box retailer tanked 15% today. Urban Outfitters reported today higher than expected sales. Shares jumped 5.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Robert Mueller attends a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on oversight of the FBI. President Obama speaks to troops at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, about the end of the Iraq War. And on December 14, 1799, George Washington, the first U.S. president, died at his Mount Vernon home. He was 67. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Depending on where you live, you might have seen something new in the parking lot at your local grocery store. A big blue bin into which you can put old books as a donation for charity. The bins are in 11 states, from California out to Massachusetts. But the company behind the whole thing turns out to be one of the country's biggest for-profit book recyclers. Claudine LaMonaco has more from Prescott, Arizona.
There was no mistaking the message on the large blue bins. They read Books for Charity in bright yellow letters 5 inches tall. Richard Cady first saw one in this Safeway supermarket parking lot last year. A volunteer with the Prescott Public Library, Cady went over to get a closer look.
It said something about helping children to read.
But then he read the small print. It said some of the books would be sold to cover expenses.
I sort of had a bad feeling about it. It didn't seem quite right.
It turns out the bins are owned by a for-profit company called Thrift Recycling Management, or TRM. The company does donate some of the books through a charity it helped create called The Reading Tree. But it also sells the books on places like Amazon.com. Last year, the company brought in $27 million. The Reading Tree's website doesn't mention any of that. Cady said it felt deceptive.
The average little old lady who's going grocery shopping at Safeway is not going to figure this out. She's going to think that those books are going to children, and I don't think that's always the case.
The bins worry Cady because he helps run Prescott Library's used bookshop. It raises thousands of dollars for library programs by selling donated books. Like many friends of library groups around the country, Cady worries the bins are siphoning off donations that normally would come to them. The blue bins have also caught the eye of law enforcement.
We're looking into whether or not donors were misled in any way about how much of the proceeds are going to actual charitable purposes and how much are going to a for-profit company.
That's Tony Green from the Oregon State Department of Justice. In May, the department began investigating TRM. TRM's chief executive, Phil McMullen, wouldn't tell me how much of its $27 million in revenue comes from the blue bins. But he said the company donates 25% of the books it gets from the bins.
Does TRM make money at it? Sure. Are we driving Rolls Royces? No. Are we delighted with the service we're providing? We are.
He said 50% of the books they get from the bins are in such bad shape, they get recycled to keep them out of landfills. Tax documents the Reading Tree filed in 2009 show the group donated more than 1 million books to charities.
There's nobody in the whole country that gives 1 million books a year away for free.
I spoke to nearly all the schools and literacy groups in Arizona that TRM says it aided over the last year, about 24. And the donations are for real. Ellen Dean runs Book Pals. She said TRM and the Reading Tree helps her group get thousands of high-quality books to kids at poor schools every year.
A lot of these children have no books in their house. They may have the telephone book and a Bible. But it's not typical that these families have libraries at home. So we help them start that.
McMullen concedes his company needs to refine its message. Thrift Recycling Management has been changing the wording on the bins. The bin at the Prescott Safeway now reads, donate books, but it still doesn't say some of the books will be sold for profit. In Prescott, Arizona, I'm Claudine LaMonica for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment of our lives every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. The subject matter is the hidden side of everything, as it usually is. Dubner, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Kai, and I have a question for you,
if you
don't mind.
That's kind of the way these things go, isn't it?
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate America's food, I'm curious to know.
America's food? Yeah. Oh, okay, big topics. 7.3.
Yeah, all right. So
so is there a right answer or a wrong answer?
No, there's no right answer. Right. I was curious to know because you know why? We love to complain about our food.
Yes.
And for those who like to complain, there's a new book coming out called An Economist Gets Lunch by Tyler Cowen. And he explains how, he puts it, American food got bad. And some of the explanations are really interesting. For starters, he blames prohibition.
A lot of good restaurants, they make a lot of the profits on the drinks. When you shut down their ability to sell wine, beer, and other drinks, basically it put them all out of business. Those quality restaurants, within a period of a year or two, they vanished.
But prohibition was like 80 years ago, man.
It is true, but many profound effects have distant causes, as I've tried to teach you, Grasshopper. So, no, actually, it's not that. Anyway, but, you know, we did bounce back, but what we did is we bounced back in volume of restaurants. But a lot of them were diners and cafeterias. Cowen says that we began to cater more than any other nation to our children's palates.
Compared to a lot of Asian cultures or European cultures, when it comes to the food scene, very often in America, the child is in charge, and that again means soft and sweet and gooey.
Ew. So you've got soft, sweet, and gooey taking center stage, plus, Cowen argues, a lack of new flavors. Now, can you guess why we didn't get any new flavors?
A lack of new flavors. No, I got nothing.
Immigration. That's the argument. Or really the lack of immigration.
Right,
so
right.
The Immigration Act of 1924 set quotas in this country that weren't lifted until the 60s. More immigration generally means more food innovation.
Right.
New everything. Spices, ingredients, know-how, strategies. And we weren't getting a lot of either of those.
Well, let me throw another one at you, though, just for the heck of it. What about convenience, right? We were in the 40s and 50s a more mobile society. We wanted convenience. We wanted frozen. We wanted drive-through, all that good stuff.
That's exactly right. And Cowen, he says that this is interesting. It's kind of a byproduct of World War II, which is that during the war, out of necessity, we had to learn to can and package and transport food on a much bigger scale than ever before. And then when the war ended, we liked our spam. We hung on to it. And all those processes that came along with it. What's interesting, though, is that in Europe, World War II had exactly the opposite effect.
It shut down a lot of transportation. It shut down a lot of borders. So people ate very locally. They would grow things in their gardens. You know, they might even eat the family pet, do things that we might not find that tasty or that pleasant. But the result in Europe was to make things more local, not less.
All right. So now that I think about it, the family pet is probably like a cow or a pig, not Fido, right?
Depends on your family, kind.
Depends on the, yes. Okay.
I can't speak for your family.
That's,
I don't
that's
know.
That's right. And local makes sense too, right?
It does. And, you know, American food now, Cowen and just about everybody else argues, is on the upswing. And a big part of that is this local movement, the idea that we should all eat more local food, maybe all local food, which might taste better often. But as a solution to the food future, the idea of feeding more and more people around the world nutritious and affordable food, Cowen argues that the locavore movement is a little bit snobbish and a lot impractical.
The biggest food problem in the world today is that agricultural productivity is slowing down, and for a lot of the world, food prices are going up. And for that, we need more business, technology, and innovation, not locavorism. Man.
You are going to get such hate mail, can I tell you?
Well, I think we should direct the hate mail to you this time after the turkey breast incident, if you don't mind.
I'm still hearing about that. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. Couple of weeks, huh?
Talk to you soon, Kai. Thanks.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the prequel of which you might have seen on Saturday Night Live last week.
On Wednesday this week, actor Alec Baldwin was kicked off an American Airlines flight after he refused to turn off his phone and stop playing Words with Friends. Now, here to comment, the pilot of that flight, Captain Steve Rogers.
That's Alec Baldwin, of course, playing the pilot.
On behalf of everyone at American Airlines, issue an apology to Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Alec, are you sure this is the right way to handle this?
Yeah, keep going.
So it's funny, unless you're a flight attendant. The Hollywood Reporter said today that the Association of Professional Flight Attendants wants American Airlines to take Baldwin's show 30 Rock, a huge hit for NBC, off its flights unless he apologizes for real this time. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow gave back 66 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 32 points. S&P 500 off 10 points. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay, Sonata Lee Narcisse, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, how honest do you think members of Congress are? How about as honest as car salesmen and lobbyists? Yeah, I know, not good. A new installment of Attitude Check, our partnership with Gallup, on the broadcast tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that. This is APM, American Public Media.